We are thrilled to present the first edition of the Asian Bookshelf, home to words and voices in Asia Today, an exciting new podcast about literary facts and fiction from across the region. The Asian Bookshelf will bring you opinions, interviews, and news from a diverse range of contemporary voices, from Asian-based writers, publishers, readers, and bookstore owners. This is a deep literary conversation, so we'd love to hear your insights as well. This season, our spotlight is on Singapore.
In his parents' time, they'd already comprised less than 1% of the population. Each time he'd returned home from his postings at sea, there seemed to be fewer of them. He remembered how, growing up, his parents would make dinner table jokes about how their kind would soon vanish, like the vaquita head, as a few Eurasians left kept marrying into other cultures. Later, he began thinking it wasn't so much like a species dying of extinction. It was more like a drop of ink dissolving into a bowl of water. Slowly, the tendrils of pigment would fade and blend into the larger body, until finally, there would be no evidence the original color ever existed.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Asian Bookshelf, where we explore Southeast Asia's literary landscape. In this episode, episode one of the Asian Bookshelf, we will discuss Others Is Not a Race by Melissa De Silva. Our focus is on its narrative structure and the theme of primary identity. I'm Devika Misra, a Singapore-based former radio journalist and editor, and now an English coach.
I'm T.A. Morton, an Irish-Australian writer based in Singapore. My most recent novella is called Someone Is Coming and is published by Monsoon Books.
I'm John Gresham, and my debut novel, Gus, The Life and Opinions of the Last Raffles Banded Langur, will be in the shops with Epigram Books.
And we think the best way to begin is Melissa De Silva's Others Is Not a Race. Originally published in 2017, it has been recently re-released by Monsoon Books.
Naming, she reflected, confers a sense of identity. To leave someone unnamed, the unwanted infant, the rent of the litter, marks it for a life of inconsequence.
Tracy, you spoke to Melissa recently. Tell us about her.
Well, Melissa has worked as a journalist and editor. She won the Singapore Literature Prize for creative nonfiction for this book, actually, back in 2018. And CNA did a show with Melissa recently about tracing the history of Singapore Eurasians, and it's called My Debol Diaries, which was actually shown on TV last Christmas. You can also find it on YouTube. She is currently writing a new novel about climate change.
Letter to anonymous policymaker regarding Others Is Not a Race. Others, it said on the form. She considered that for a moment. What did others mean? Others from whose point of view? As if some were conferred insider status and some not. The others.
The narrative documents her experience of growing up, often feeling invisible, misunderstood, ignored. Her story is really about the loss of one's identity. It's a very sweet, very personal journey of searching for one's cultural roots. At least that's how I read it. But what do you think, John? After all, you belong to this ethnic category of others. Did the book work for you?
Yes, I'm an others other. Yes, I liked it a lot. I think it's a welcome addition to Singapore literature for two reasons. I think it introduces creative nonfiction to Singapore readers. She's using different forms to explore her Eurasian identity. She's got personal experience, she's got family history, she's got food and recipes, failed fishing trips, short stories and speculative fiction. She's got this letter, this passionate letter to an anonymous policymaker. And she also discusses Kristang and the importance of language, sort of led by people like Kevin Martins Wong. So that's one of the reasons I like it. And I do think, secondly, it's really important to highlight a community group with significant involvement in Singapore life and history and culture and society since before British colonial times, the Eurasians.
I think for such a small book, there's a lot in it. She writes it in such an interesting way. It's not really a traditional story arc as such, you know, because it is classified as being creative nonfiction. Each chapter is very different. You know, we get glimpses into her journey with her relationship with looking at Kristang, language, the food, and recalling stories from the past. This book is really about an individual's journey and looking at their past. And each chapter, you know, in its own way, the way she tells it is fragmented. And I love that. It really resonates with the human experience, you know, in trying to make sense of our own past, you know, from reminiscing about her childhood to being anxious when she's baking the sugi cake, you know, that her grandmother made. It's all so very relatable, even to a foreigner like me. And as someone that really enjoys going to the archives, me personally, here in Singapore, I really enjoyed that she labels some chapters as sources, you know. She labeled as told to Melissa De Silva by her mother. I thought that was like a testament and even a way of validating what she was trying to convey, which I guess is trying to grasp hold of something that perhaps she's ignored from a number of years and that really speaks to her soul.
Others. Who determined which people were others and which people weren't? Just because there were fewer of them, did that mean they counted for less? Come on, they had been there since the beginning, except for the original Temasek dwellers. But since the first unions between the Portuguese and the Asians in Malaya in the 1500s. There were many Eurasians in colonial times and after independence, who had contributed to the development of the country too. Yet, it was as if they'd been obscured from the official narrative. After decades of working together, building, and living side by side, did it come down to this? 6 meaningless letters on a form? Others. What does it mean, she wondered, when policymakers willfully choose to see some within society as other, as people on the outside, as if they were invisible. Many Singaporeans were ignorant that they were even fellow citizens. She recalled reading an article online, 7 things we can all learn from Joseph Schooling's Olympic win, something like that. And number 7 was, Eurasians are born and bred Singaporeans too. Wow. Seriously? Like it was some kind of revelation. Why the ignorance? It was obvious. It was the Chinese, Malays, and Indians who were mentioned, in that order, at every official speech involving national policy matters. And others, they were mentioned too, last. And most Singaporeans had no idea who or what these others were. And who could blame them with such a foggy term? And so the perception that Singapore is only made up of Chinese, Malays, and Indians is reinforced over and over again with each policy speech, each flourish of government data, effectively conditioning a nation.
Again, it's another very sensitive area. And it's the aspect of how Eurasians leverage their access to white privilege to survive and thrive, especially in colonial times. And that's probably a very sensitive area. So I can understand why Melissa probably shies away from that. But again, It's where I would like to see more analysis and more discussion of that and reflection by somebody from that community.
Their kind would soon vanish, like the vaquita head, as a few Eurasians left kept marrying into other cultures. Later, he began thinking it wasn't so much like a species dying of extinction. It was more like a drop of ink dissolving into a bowl of water. Slowly, the tendrils of pigment would fade and blend into the larger body, until finally, there would be no evidence the original colour ever existed. All memory of them would be blurred away, and the Singaporeans remaining would be free of an uncomfortable reminder of a time when Europeans had crowed at the top of the social ladder, and the Asians, indigenous to Singapore, as well as settlers from China, India, and the Indonesian archipelago, had allowed themselves to be ruled.
White privilege. Very interesting, Tracy. You are white.
And Irish, what? Though. I would just like to clarify that to everyone that I'm Irish.
So what's your take on this?
Well, I mean, I get it. You know, as the Eurasians, they lose access in a post-colonial era and it unleashes like this host of complex identity issues. You know, there's definitely a question of where they belong now. But it is incredible that Kristang was spoken widely in the 17th century by so many different nationalities, you know, from the Dutch to Malaccan to Cantonese, and now it's kind of almost vanished. You know, we have four major languages here, and thankfully, you know, as a foreigner, most people speak English, which is great. But at what cost is that to individual identities? You know, all those stories, you know, as a writer, I think about all those stories, folklores, ghost stories that were told in so many different languages, and they all had different meanings, interpretations. And, you know, a lot of that can be lost in translation. Eurasians did hold a really interesting position during colonial times. You know, I first really read about their position in W. Somerset Maugham's short story, especially the letter, and saw that they did have a great advantage in being like a go-between, you know, with the locals and the colonials. I do believe within this book, though, Melissa has also very gently dealt with this, especially towards the end in the futuristic short story, which I love. I think it's the best part of this book, The Blind Date, where two of her characters are the last two registered Eurasians in Singapore. And it's like they've lost so much due to their position and they've almost paid a price.
He lifts his face and the gold flecks in his eyes spark. Martin continues to stand, leaning heavily on his walking stick, as he watches a small man tread down the path out of the dome. The slight figure makes its way onto the pedestrian lane alongside the cycle rush, growing tinier and tinier as it bobs along the undulating ribbon of traffic, until finally it dissolves into a pulsating sweep of humanity.
I hear you. Actually, in fact, in India, it was a very similar story. Singapore was, in fact, ruled out of British India for many years, and the Raj there too created a privileged social class, Macaulayism. That was an Indian administrator, British Indian administrator. Macaulayism was a policy to promote an English-speaking elite, and this privileged English-speaking Indian elite served as a bridge between the white rulers and their native subjects, and I am cringing as I use these words, native and white.
Yeah.
But I see that similarity, and I think the Eurasians played that role here in the Strait Settlements. I mean, when we say Strait Settlements, we are talking about Singapore, Malacca, and Penang. So they played this role as the go-between between the rulers and the ruled, and that's how colonialism was so successful in Southeast Asia and in India. But my point here, Tracy, is things have changed. Mm-hmm. We do not have colonialism anymore. Life has moved on. Life has moved on a lot more in modern day Singapore. So is Melissa De Silva just hanging on a bit as a naive romantic? I mean, is she just hankering back to old times for the sake of old times? Do we really need to hang on to Kristang, a language that very few people have heard of, let alone actually speak? And then she talks about foods like suji. Suji is semolina, semolina cake. Do we need that in Singapore in 2024?
Yes. I believe it's really important to hold on to these aspects of the past, and especially right now in Singapore. You know, we're faced day in and day out with living with these huge kind of multinational corporations, you know, and restaurants like McDonald's, KFC and Starbucks that are on every corner. I particularly liked it actually in the book when Melissa is sitting in a 24-hour Starbucks and she's trying to recall Eurasian dishes to someone in a very awkward conversation, and she can't recall any. And I love that juxtaposition of her sitting in a global brand like Starbucks, and then the fact she can't recall dishes she identifies herself with. It's almost as if this homogenization with global brands perhaps dilutes her own self-identity. I think she shows us here a certain vulnerability that comes with being identified with a race, especially one that she's trying to grab tightly hold of before, as she writes in the last chapter, before it's too late. Others is 1.6 of the demographic, which for me seems so small. It's really a question of identity within this book and race. But I would ask, is race the only identity marker here in Singapore today?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's a much more complex picture. John, what do you think?
I think government planning and policy making must look at an array of complex data points. And I think Singapore does that. I think there are socioeconomic factors like household income, your job, your age, etc. And Singapore looks at those when it makes decisions. And again, it has in the constitution that it's regardless of race and religion. But obviously there are sort of structural injustices and issues. But it's not my place to critique or analyze that, on especially on this podcast, which is about the book. I do think identity is fluid, and it's important to view identity intersectionally with an understanding of power and structural relationships. I mean, we ourselves define ourselves in multiple ways, not just our race, not just our religion and class, but by our jobs, where we live, our school, our gender, our sexuality. We're more than one thing. Mm. And literature is great. Books are great at exploring this and the tensions arising. So I think it's important to understand the difference between roots, R-O-O-T-S, and roots in a Stuart Hall, the cultural theorist sense, that's R-O-U-T-E-S. And Melissa's book does a good job at exploring the meaning of Eurasian in terms of R-O-U-T-E-S, where you're looking at the experiences of a community, the connections and relationships made and flourishing within that community. And it's not in a dogmatic or an exclusionary way, but it's a book that embraces the things that mean a lot to people in that Eurasian community. And I think that's what she does really, really well. She highlights the things that have meant so much to a lot of Eurasian people.
Yes, absolutely. And I completely see where you're coming from. I mean, it's not for us to critique the CMIO policy, because if you critique it, the question is, what does one replace it with?
Exactly.
Very big question. So I think we should see this work in the context of a sense of sadness, not just about the loss of privilege, though that, of course, indeed, it may play a role, but more in the context of the loss of community. So there's a vulnerability here, more than just anger. Sadness, really, I suppose, rather than just nostalgia for nostalgia's sake.
So there is a sense of vulnerability to all our past. And it's not only because this category has gotten so diluted here in Singapore. Eroding ethnic categories is in fact a reflection of modern life, of globalization, interracial marriage. But literature, as John said, is one of the most effective and impactful ways to combat our collective past being erased. It helps in grounding our identity, and in so can help ground ourselves in the modern world. In this work, this has been achieved far more powerfully, I think, than any other Eurasian story that I know of. But of course, I would like to ask any readers out there if they know of any other Eurasian story that deals with similar issues. So thanks to everybody. Thanks, John. Thanks to Vika and to Melissa De Silva. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of The Asian Bookshelf and have a deeper understanding of Melissa De Silva's Others Is Not a Race. We trust that this conversation has given you as much pleasure as it's given us to produce. Of course, our interpretations and opinions aren't the only valid ones, and we'd love to hear from you at contact@theasianbookshelf.com or in the show notes below. Please follow or subscribe to The Asian Bookshelf on your favorite podcast platform. You can also find us on X, formerly Twitter, at AsianTheBooks, and Facebook and Instagram at The Asian Bookshelf. And do join us for our next insightful conversation. Coming up is Elaine Chu's new fantasy romance, The Light Between Us, where we'll be joined by the author herself and focus on the magical power of images across time and space. Many thanks for listening to The Asian Bookshelf, home to words and voices from Asia today.